Good morning, may it please the court, I'm Carrie Ann Lucas. I am, my bar number is 36620. I'm counsel for Ms. MEC. With me at council table is Ginger Geisinger. Her bar number is 35311. She's counsel for Mr. J.E.Z. And we'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, I'll be happy to let you know that when we get to that point.
Colorado Revised Statute 19-3604-1B1 violates the Americans with Disabilities Act by treating people who have a particular class of disabilities differently than all other people without regard, without requiring reasonable modifications and reasonable accommodations under both the ADA and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. The United States Supreme Court and Colorado Supreme Court have consistently held under the Supremacy Clause that any state law that conflicts with federal law is without effect. And here, to allow a court to find that there is no appropriate treatment plan on the basis of emotional or mental condition without ensuring that the parent was provided with reasonable accommodations and reasonable modifications conflicts with the clear purpose of the ADA and therefore the law as written is invalid.
Ms. Lucas, to what extent did you raise this issue in the district court?
Raised it on at oral arguments. We raised it throughout the at various times throughout the case in earlier portions of the case and when termination was first filed on this issue, and it's specifically preserved that that this violates. That 19-3604-1B violates ADA and Section 504 in transcript 2, line or page 72, lines 12 through page 74, line 11.
Okay, and one other clarifying question: are you challenging the constitutionality of that statute you just mentioned on its face, or as applied, or both?
Both, primarily as it's applied, but also on its face.
Okay.
And it's undisputed that these parents here do not meet any of the other conditions in 19-3604-1B, where parents are have long-term incarcerations and committed heinous crimes against children. These parents, it's undisputed, they don't fall under any of those sections. And therefore, the only reason they were not provided with a treatment plan and reasonable efforts to reunify with their child is on the basis of their emotional and mental disabilities. The legislature could, as the TB case has been interpreted by the guardian ad litem and the county attorney, is that under that type of interpretation, the legislature could pass a law that says no treatment plan is required for parents who use wheelchair, or no treatment plan is required for parents who are blind. And that means that disabled people, including people with mental and emotional conditions, have a right without a remedy in child protection cases, and that is not the intent of Congress.
Can I ask you about that, Ms. Lucas? So you've made, I guess this is your facial argument, that 19-3604-1B1 violates the ADA because I think your phrase was that it mandates termination if there's a mental illness or mental disability. And I guess I'm trying to figure out where do you read that, because as I read it, I just want you to push back on me. It says that you can't devise a treatment plan because of unfitness, and one of the grounds are emotional illness, mental illness, etc., of such duration that the parent is unlikely within a reasonable time to care for the ongoing physical, mental, and emotional needs. It's that latter piece that I'm trying to figure out how it fits with your argument. That does, I would have serious concerns if the statute said what you're characterizing, I think, as, you know, if you're mentally ill, we can just decide we can't create a treatment plan done. I think it's more limited than that, and I, again, disagree with me by all means. It seems to me it says you can't have a treatment plan because this illness makes it unlikely that the parent won't be able to care for the child in a reasonable time. Doesn't that provide a limiting principle?
The issue is though, what that does not do is require reasonable accommodations and reasonable modifications to ensure that the parents are provided the services that to promote reunification that are commensurate with their disability and appropriate for the disability, which did not happen here. So that's where the problem is that this statute does not have that qualifier that first you have to provide those reasonable accommodations and those reasonable modifications to ensure that the parent is not able to ameliorate this condition and be a fit parent in a reasonable amount of time.
But doesn't the court really need to look at whether there were reasonable accommodations tried before it finds that we can't develop a treatment plan?
Yes, it does, and that did not happen here, and that's the issue. That's exactly what should happen, is that the court should be looking at whether accommodations and modifications were applied. It's just the same in an employment context, where you have to determine whether somebody can do a particular essential function of the job with the provision of accommodations and modifications. And the same thing should happen here, but that's not what's happening.
I can ask you a follow-up question and I'll shut up.
You're fine. Just
a fact, my colleagues may have, just a factual question. I do recall that the caseworker here said, you know, we don't have to provide accommodations, or something that was struck me as kind of strange, and maybe the caseworker needs to look a little more at her role. But there's this other woman, I think it was one of Ms. Brex, who does seem to have provided a number of services and was involved from the government side here. Can you address that? Didn't Ms. Brex try to provide all these services?
Ms. Brex made referrals or made contacts to the ARC of Greeley, or ARC of Weld County, as well as the Greeley Center for Independence, looking at general services, not specific to parenting. She was helping them find furniture. She made referrals to food banks and churches to help the family, help the parents obtain food assistance. She helped them with problems with their landlord and conditions in their apartment. So she provided some regular general services, as she referred to them, was the term that she used, not specific to parenting and to help them improve their parenting skills.
So let me ask you this question. I know you said Ms. Geisinger might talk about reasonable services, but if you want to defer to her, that's fine. But do you think that the state statutory requirement that the department has to provide reasonable services subsumes the ADA requirement of reasonable accommodations?
No, it's not specific enough, and particularly as the TD case has been applied in courts, is that it's being taken that once you get to the termination phase, if a parent raises the issue of whether or not reasonable modifications and reasonable accommodations were provided, which are different than reasonable efforts. There has to be, if you look at the Department of Justice letter of finding, they specifically reference things like a parent aid, things like different types of in-home services, that the county has an obligation to then modify their services to ensure that they're accessible to a parent with a disability. And here, that did not happen. The caseworker did not even look outside the city of Greeley for services specific to Ms. MEZ's mental illness.
So can you explain to us what specific accommodations, you just mentioned a parent aid as a possibility. Are there other specific suggestions that you think could apply in this case?
I mean, specifically in this case, the caseworker did not look at other services outside her. She just didn't look for services, period. That was her testimony. She just said it was her. She didn't have any obligation to provide referrals to parents. That isn't her job as a caseworker, which I think Judge Gabriel referred, which is shocking for the position of a caseworker. But specifically, Dr. Lindstrom had a number of recommendations for services, an intensive day treatment parent-child program. He had recommendations for increased parenting time. That was never done. There were recommendations that there be some hands-on parenting education and life coaching. That's the record of 303. He recommended that Ms. MEZ participate in the clubhouse services, and that parent-specific parenting education at transcript 109. And he made those recommendations with the expectation that they would be implemented for this family, and they were not.
Can you tell me what the clubhouse services were? I wasn't sure about that.
He was referring to a type of day treatment program for people with mental illness, and he was specifically looking for one that would also allow a mother and her child to be together.
And didn't Ms. Brex make the referral to that service, and Mom refused it?
She recommended it. It was not part of her treatment plan, and that's where the issue comes. She made the recommendation, but it was not part of her treatment plan. We specifically asked for those things to become part of her treatment plan. In fact, did an earlier appeal on this issue that the treatment plan was not sufficient. The TV case holds that the ADA is not a defense to termination of parental rights. And they agree, nothing in the ADA prevents states from terminating the rights of parents with disabilities, provided that those parents first receive reasonable accommodations and modifications appropriate to their disabilities. And that can be in the court setting as well as in with the actual county and the services provided. And ensuring that those accommodations and modifications were made part of reasonable efforts does not raise the parents' rights above the child. It's just simply part of the analysis that courts need to specifically make when assessing whether reasonable efforts were made for a parent with a disability. And the DOJ, Department of Justice Health and Human Services letter of finding is instructive here, that the Department of Justice, which has the greatest understanding of Title II of the ADA, relied on the Yeske decision. And it's the precise type of case that we have before us here today. And the Supreme Court has said that the Title II ADA regulations warrant respect. And in the Olmstead versus LC decision, which I believe is not cited in our briefs, and that's 527 U.S. 581, pages 597-98, and it's a 1999 decision. And rather than analyzing regulations, to see if the ADA regulations are entitled to the full deference under Chevron, the court concluded it's enough to observe that the well-reasoned view of the agencies implementing a statute constitute a body of experience-informed judgment to which courts and litigants may properly resort to for guidance. Here, these parents are denied an equal opportunity to reunify with their son because the caseworkers simply did not implement any of the recommendations that Dr. Lindstrom, their own expert, recommended. She didn't, as I mentioned, search outside of Greeley. She didn't even make a referral to Envision, the community center board for people with developmental disabilities, to see if they could provide any services to help her with her parenting. And 1936041B1 does not require public entities to make modifications to policies, practices, and procedures pursuant to the ADA. And but for their disabilities, the court could not have found that there was no appropriate treatment plan for these parents. It only can occur, with the exception of the other circumstances in 1936041B, which everyone agrees that do not apply to these parents, but it's only due to their disability that the court could make a finding that their reasonable efforts and a treatment plan are not required. And that's where the discrimination comes into play. And there's nothing in the statutory language of the ADA that suggests that Congress intended to exclude modifications that modify state statutory requirements. And it's unlikely they would have hidden any such significant limitation except with a deliberate statutory phrase like reasonable modifications. Because when Congress did want to restrict the scope of the ADA, it did so explicitly. We're looking at the definition of people with disability as well as in Title I.
Ms. Lucas, you asked to reserve 2 minutes for your rebuttal argument. You're just under 2 minutes now. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
May it please the court. My name is Tommy Hansen. My bar number is 39124. The GAL is aligned with the department in this case. She's seated at council table with me. Her name is Jennifer Cleggern. Her bar number is 28343.
Does she intend to present part of the oral argument or just you?
I was going to start presenting if the court does have specific questions for her from a child perspective or best interest of the child, she will answer those.
Okay.
So we'll leave that up to the court if you want to inquire as to questions.
Thank you for that clarification.
The Court of Appeals cannot address issues that are brought up for the first time on appeal. That's People in the Interest of VW, 958 Pacific 2nd, 1132, Colorado Court of Appeals, 1998. I do not agree with Ms. Lucas that these issues were brought up at the no appropriate slash termination of parental rights hearing in this case. I don't believe any of the issues were properly preserved for appeal in respondent father's brief, and there is an incorrect standard of review cited in the petition on appeal as well. There's no standard of review listed in respondent mother's supplemental brief at all, and there's no cite to the record where it's brought up. I do not believe they are properly before the court at this time. I do believe they are first brought up on appeal.
Ms. Lucas just cited to us a little while ago a specific place in the record where the, she says this issue was brought up on pages 72 to 74 of the transcript. Do you disagree with that?
I do. I believe that Ms. Lucas, it was an afterthought. In my review of the transcript, this was not, the ADA or any of these issues were not brought up. She argued them in closing. None of them were actually litigated in the actual hearing. There was no evidence presented as far as accommodation. She references Section 504. If you read the transcript of the hearing and the evidence, those words do not appear anywhere in the transcript.
But aren't those two different things? I mean, Ms. Luke, it may be a risk for a party to not put on specific evidence, but then they argue the legal principle and say, court, look at the evidence and put two and two together. Can you not preserve a legal question by raising it in closing argument? Again, you may be at risk if you didn't put on evidence, but that's a different question.
I guess the way I read the rules, you can't. I will leave that to the court. I do have further argument as to the merits of the case, but I do believe they were not properly preserved for appeal. Getting to the actual arguments, the state has a compelling interest in these cases. There's been federal law and state law that talks about the correct burden for terminating parental rights, and that's clear and convincing evidence. The trial court in this case found that the department proved beyond a reasonable doubt the criminal standard, that these parents were unfitness and there were no services that could be put in place in the entire state of Colorado to remedy the unfitness of the parents.
Does the court have to make some effort to try before making that finding? Maybe bastardizing Ms. Lucas's argument, but I think that's pretty much what she's saying. Before you conclude there's no plan we could adopt, you've got to make an effort. And I think Ms. Lucas's argument is it wasn't here.
Well, I guess I have sort of a twofold response to that. I think case law in Colorado actually would be not what Ms. Lucas said. There is case law in Colorado that there has been findings where the department can terminate, even in the motion, you can terminate under more than one basis of the statute. So there's actually current case law in the state of Colorado that says you don't have to have a treatment plan if you can prove by clear and convincing evidence that all of the statutory requirements are there. The court may, in its discretion, and it is a may, it's not a shall, may terminate parental rights. So I actually disagree with Ms. Lucas's characterization. I do think by law government agencies, which the department would be one, does have to set forth reasonable accommodations and modifications as part of the treatment plan.
So I think, excuse me, Ms. Hansen, for interrupting you. So are you saying in that last statement that the ADA does apply to departments of social or human services?
I think it does apply. I think also, though, the current case law that says it's not a defense to termination, I don't think those are the same issue. I think it is two separate and distinct issues.
Well, excuse me again for interrupting. As I understand Ms. Lucas's argument, mm-hmm. she's also in agreement that the issue of termination and the issue of provision of services are two different issues. Am I correct in surmising that you both agree that those are separate issues?
I believe so.
Okay.
What I was going to say further is, in the ADA, because the department does have to make reasonable accommodations and modifications in my reading of the law, the department also, of course, by law has to make reasonable efforts. The trial court found that the department had made reasonable efforts at multiple hearings before the termination hearing occurred. So starting back from May of 2014, basically every hearing, that's one of the things the trial court has to decide, is the department making reasonable efforts? And that finding was made at every hearing, up into and at, including at, that final no appropriate slash termination hearing.
I have another follow-up question. In your view, is the state statutory requirement for reasonable efforts the coextensive or the same as the ADA requirements?
I think that if you read the law together, it is sufficient. The ADA clearly is separate from the state statutes and what's required in reasonable efforts. But I think if you read them together, that it does require, because the department is required to provide those things. Also, I think if you're thinking about it from a treatment planning issue, treatment plans need to be set forth to make a parent fit. So if those accommodations or modifications would be required and are needed, those should be set forth in the treatment plan, which is one of the issues that I definitely disagree with Ms. Lucas on. She just stated on the record that they asked for clubhouse services to be put in place. They did not. There was a hearing, the first hearing, on April 10th of 2014. The department set forth its proposed treatment plan for adoption by the court. Both counsel for the respondent parents objected. We actually set a hearing. So we had a contested hearing on treatment plans on April 25th of 2014. That hearing, the judge basically adopted three objectives. There was the first one for to communicate and cooperate, basically to do the site evals, to do the PCIs, things that the department did put in place. The third one was to for the parents to visit. They've been visiting all case. In this case, actually, they've been visiting at the therapeutic parenting level. Ms. Lucas stated that Ms. Brett tried to put in place services but didn't address parenting. Her number one role and the reason she was involved in this case was she is a therapeutic parenting supervisor at the Parenting Education Center for the department. That was her main role. These other things she did, because neither of the parents had any type of relationship with the caseworker and would not speak with the caseworker, all of these things, if you look at the trial court's findings, the trial court made findings about all of these evidentiary issues. Also, the treatment plans, the court ordered for the hearing on April 25th, the court ordered that both respondent parent counsel submit their own then proposed treatment plan because they believed ours was insufficient. Neither of the treatment plans, which are in the record, you can review them, neither of respondent parent counsel's treatment plans ever mentioned clubhouse services, ARC, Envision, or any type of services for DD parents at all whatsoever. Further, after that hearing, there was an appeal. That decision from April 25th from that hearing was appealed to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals found that the court did not abuse their discretion, and the trial court in that hearing, what they did was a reasonable treatment plan for this case for these parents. Even after the appeal, there was still no mention there, if you look through the record, there's never been any time at any point where they brought up, they didn't ask to amend the treatment plan, there wasn't anything until the termination. Case law in Colorado is also very clear that it's the parent's burden to bring up any insufficiencies in the treatment plan prior to the termination hearing. Bringing it up at the termination hearing is not enough. That is insufficient, and that is current case law in Colorado as well. So I don't believe that any modification, if you look at the record, there's no modification. There was never any ask for accommodations or modifications to the treatment plan. I also believe that Ms. Lucas's statements about Dr. Lindstrom's recommendations are taken out of context and also not accurate. Dr. Lindstrom testified, and if you look at his testimony, he testified that in his knowledge of what is offered in Colorado, there is no service in Colorado that could deal with the severity, pervasiveness, or chronic nature of these parents' mental health issues. The primary uncontested evidence in this case, primary issue in this case was the parents' mental health. Their mental illness was not DD, it wasn't about accommodations. He testified, and actually even the respondent mother testified, she wouldn't cooperate with in-home services. Ms. Brex testified on the stand about accommodations and modifications that she made to the parenting curriculum in trying to do parenting with the parents. She also testified in the almost 1 year of therapeutic visits that she's was basically monitoring and helping them, trying to get them to engage with their child, there was no progress. So there's no progress in any parenting. There were accommodations and modifications made. As far as reasonable efforts, the court and what the court found is that the department provided psychological evaluations of both respondent parents. There was a parent-child interactional evaluation of both parents. There was therapeutic visitation throughout the case offered to both respondent parents. There was an attempt to get respondent mother to engage in clubhouse services. She refused. Like I said, respondent mother testified at the hearing. She testified that she needed no help raising her son. She would refuse any in-home services offered by the department. Respondent mother testified that she would not take her medication without her mental health certification case. This respondent mother was hospitalized in and out of hospitalizations for the first 5 months of this EPP case. She was hospitalized at Fort Logan, at Highlands Behavioral Health, and the acute treatment unit at North Range Behavioral Health. On and off, she actually was not present when we did the adjudicatory hearing. She was hospitalized. She was hospitalized basically because even though she was on her medication, she was still so unstable that she could not live on her own in the community. She had to be hospitalized to then be medicated. They changed her medications and she was restabilized. She was hospitalized for so long, like I said, that she spent the first 4 to 5 months in and out of these hospitalizations.
Was she hospitalized voluntarily or involuntarily?
Both. One of them was an involuntary that her therapist and people had said yes and recommended and got her help when the case had first started. Another one, I guess I would consider it voluntary. She called the police. When they got there, she was basically out of it enough that they then took her to an emergency room where then she was held on a 72-hour hold, which was longer than 72 hours.
Okay.
So again, I think in this case, what the court needs to look at is the severity, pervasiveness, and chronic nature of the mental illness. That is the unfitness. So.
Thank you, Ms. Hanson. We appreciate your argument. Ms. Lucas, you have just under 2 minutes.
Your Honor, with respect to your last question, Ms. Anuzzi, all of her hospitalizations, she was initially placed on a hold, but all of her hospitalizations after that point were voluntary. She agreed to the hospitalization. With respect to refusing services in the home, Ms. Anuzzi specifically testified she had concerns about having services in her home because of the conditions of her apartment complex and that there was a locked door, getting access to the building was very difficult. And that was her testimony. And that's at transcript 249, 8 to 10 and 50. 18 through 51-1.
Ms. Lucas, looking at the ADA in isolation, is there any burden for the handicapped individual to identify or request a reasonable accommodation?
Specifically, if a disability is known and the accommodations are known to be needed to be provided, the public entity has an obligation to provide those even without a request.
Well, what about if they need to be identified?
Even there, in here, we had them identified by Dr. Lindstrom. The department had an obligation to do that regardless of whether the parent requested. And the ADA requires that an individual with disability need not accept an accommodation or benefit. And here, if a parent needs one and it's offered to them and they refuse, that could be a basis for an unfitness finding. But the issue is exactly where Ms. Hanson was at the end. An unfitness finding of an parent should be on the basis of their actions or inactions, not their disability label. The fact that a parent has a mental illness, that's not what makes them unfit, and that's the problem with 19-3-604-1B, is what makes them unfit is what they do or what they don't do to care for their child, and that needs to be done through the lens of having had reasonable accommodations and modifications offered to the family.
Your time is up.
Thank you,
Ms. Lucas. Thank you, Ms. Lucas. Thank you again, Ms. Hanson. We appreciate your very helpful arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. This concludes.